aspect of this film, that its title is a male name, Christopher Strong, and it refers to the Colin Clive character, who is an adulterous husband, rather than to the figure who seems central in the actual film, namely the flyer, Cynthia Darrington, played by Kate Hepburn. The film is evidently modeled on not Amelia Earhart, as that is often said in the literature, but a British equivalent of her, Amy Johnson. Both women were solo flyers around the world in the early 30s and are often either neglected or not presented fully in histories of flight. Osner notes how it was she who discovered Hepburn, evidently after the Bill of Divorcement, which had been Hepburn's initial film, relegated to Tarzan movies. She talks about going out into the set one day and seeing Katharine Hepburn half up a tree. Picking her out, though, because she seemed to embody what Osner describes as the modern type. Obviously meaning by this, I think, the new woman, as she is often called, who emerged out of the 20s suffragette movement, the type, anyway, not devoted to home, husband, and motherhood. But when the interviewers press Osner on the matter of what really interested her about the script, she declares that it was Christopher Strong, the adulterous husband of the title, who interested her most. She says it was his struggle between love for wife and child and love for the daring aviatrix that caught her sympathy. Now, I think this kind of thing is very illuminating in terms of discourses that structured Osner in the 30s and presumably still in the early 70s when she was interviewed, namely identification with the male figure. A second statement by Osner here is also ambiguous, where she talks about discovering Hepburn on the set. She mentions that she was attracted immediately by her beautiful figure. Those are her words. We might want to look, indeed, as we watch Christopher Strong, at how Hepburn's body is imaged in different parts of the film with this statement in mind. How far is her body set up as object of the gaze, as erotic object, specifically as that has been structured in patriarchy? How far is her body, on the other hand, presented non-erotically, or perhaps differently erotically? How far does Hepburn control the gaze? How far is she controlled by the male gaze? And I'm thinking here, obviously, of the camera behind which we see Osner's own control, and this in terms of how she is trying to present Hepburn to us. Now, I think it's impossible, we'll see what you think, but for a contemporary female viewer not to see the film's strategies as promoting identification with the female protagonist, despite what Osner evidently intended. And as I say, we could all be thinking about this as we watch the film. In very literal terms, we should ask ourselves, how far do the cinematic strategies, the actual use of camera and point of view shots, the editing, the lighting, seem to promote identification with Hepburn? How far identification with Colin Clive? What about the narrative as against the visual devices? How far does the narrative seem to focus on the flyer's dilemma? How far on the husband's? I think, in other words, that there are material answers to these questions that we should be able to derive from a close viewing of the film, and I hope we will have some time to discuss them afterwards. There's a particular controversy about the film's ending, which I don't want to mention for those of you who don't know the story, which many find ambiguous. And I think one's ultimate notion of what the film is trying to say about gender relations does partly depend on how you read the ending. Now, the overall issue here, I think, is the degree to which Osner's film manages to question and critique patriarchal codes governing the positioning of woman in her historical moment. And I'm interested in how far you'll think the film's strategists are interested in that question. In a sense, the subject matter of the film, which is taken from a novel based on the life of this British aviatrix I mentioned, Amy Johnson, and set in Britain, would seem already, the choice of that script, to suggest a disposition to explore the non-conforming woman who steps outside her prescribed bounds, who dares to fly. But the question is what use Osner could make of this subject matter within the constraints imposed by Hollywood and her cultural media. How gender was thought about in the 1930s, and in addition, the codes of realism that Hollywood demanded, and which I'll say a word about in a moment. How far is it possible to take the flyer seriously? Now, I think the actual historical moment, in some sense, prepared the way for this film, in that the papers in the 30s, 32 particularly, a year before the film came out, were indeed full of mention of Amelia Earhart's flight around the world. But as we know, it's precisely in situations like that where there seems to be a challenge to the patriarchy, that patriarchy returns to construct an imaginary response that would help lessen the potentially revolutionary impact of such an exploit. How far has Osner colluded in such a response? How far is Cynthia Darrington, the flyer, allowed her own discourse or permitted a discourse that really opposes the patriarchal one? The big question for some of us in feminist film theory is around desire. How far is her desire given a place? How far is she made to subjugate her desire to that of the male? And sort of further kind of situating an historical question is, how important is the achievement anyway, given the very upper class and white and privileged milieu that this film takes place in? Does the film evidence any awareness of its own race and class base? And if so, where are these moments of awareness? Now, I just want to say a brief word about the further limitation on Osner in terms of these codes of realism that Hollywood insisted on. Realism is achieved by maximizing the modes of connection between sign and referent, as we all know. The film, that is, sets up a meta-discourse through the narrative structure, which uses cause-effect relations and conflates characters with real people. Logic, coherence are the aim, and the fact that the film is written, that it is a construct, disappears. It seems as if it is an unproduced natural reality. Now, as post-structuralism has also taught us, this effect of naturalness always allows patriarchal discourse to achieve a position of authority. That is, naturalness equals the repression of the feminine voice and eradication of differences. So the question is, in this particular case, how far do the strategies here in fact work to repress Cynthia's difference, to reduce all to the monolithic patriarchal discourse? Now, feminist critics differ about their answers to the question about her voice. Some argue that the film does establish a feminist discourse, that is, one that poses challenges to the dominant gender order, but that the narrative ultimately works to silence that challenge, to bring Cynthia Darrington into the patriarchal feminine, to reestablish marriage and monogamy as a central values. Jacqueline Souter, who's written on this film, argues that the Cynthia's main function in the narrative is to bring the daughter of Strong and his wife, Elaine, who's played by Billy Burke, by the way, into monogamy and the familial. Once this is achieved, she says, Cynthia is no longer needed. Other feminists see the film on the whole as transgressive, simply in permitting a figure like Cynthia Darrington to be a heroine in the first place. And then in her, Cynthia's, politely stubborn insistence on pursuing love and her desires for both love and flying, and indeed in her final act at the end of the film. So I'd like us again to be thinking what we decide about this issue as we view it. Now, we had originally wanted also to show a feminist remake of Osner's film called Amy by Malvian Wallen, but time did not permit this. Now, I will be showing and discussing this film in April sometime, so interested people will have a chance to follow up on today. But I want now simply to note that Amy, which does not use conventional realist strategies, that uses so-called avant-garde strategies in an attempt to displace the effect of those realist strategies, that this film, Amy, offers a perspective back on Christopher Strong. That is, the remake, as it were, allows us to read the Osner film against the grain. enabling us to see how, in fact, Cynthia Darrington's deeds in Christopher Strong also cause, in Mulvey Wallen's words, quote, a rent in the fabric of family and law, end of quote. Darrington's deeds, like Amy's, are perverse in that before meeting Strong, she has put flying before love. It allows us to see how difficult patriarchy makes for women the proper fulfillment of desire for both achievements in the public world and love, family, sexual satisfaction. Amy asked the question that Oz's film, I think, implies, namely, how can we prevent the appropriation of the female discourse by dominant male culture? How can we prevent the appropriation of the heroine, the one who dares and succeeds, by a society that finds such exploits threatening? Now, our answers to these questions may well depend on our particular individual histories and generational placement. Many young women today, and I'm talking about my experience teaching now, find such questions surprising in an era that has given at least superficial recognition to women's right to large achievements. Nevertheless, the issue remains in relation to the way our culture organizes itself in terms of love, marriage, childcare, and one learns that as soon as one actually has the babies. Does that surface acceptance, in fact, go deep enough? Now, obviously, this is a complex issue, and I'm just inserting it here. We can discuss it later if it's something that interests people. Now, I want to end with a word about the difficulties of a material kind in watching this film. First of all, let alone the echoes for speeches and questions in our voices, sound will be enormously distorted in a viewing situation like this. People have done their very best to darken the room, but you see that it's not very darkened. The film, the print, we got the best print we could for this film, but I've shown it in classes and the sound is never very good anyway. And there's a further material problem to the sound, which is that, as I told you, the film is set in upper-class Britain, so we have actors and actresses with heavy upper British-class accents. Billy Burke is particularly difficult to take. There's a kind of historical problem always watching films like this in terms of acting styles and so forth. And she seems very much to overact her part. Strong also comes close to parodying the intense, repressed, earnest, upper-class British Member of Parliament. And at times Hepburn even seems to parody her role, although this is something I often feel with Hepburn in her films. And I'm not sure whether some of this isn't to do indeed with the subject matter, that indeed the whole kind of awkwardness and a sense of parodying or play with their roles isn't to do with the fact that this is indeed a very serious topic that's being raised in the film. The film opens, I just wanted to mention this since it may not be clear, with an upper-class sort of British game, an elaborate treasure hunt, in which the guests are asked to bring in very elaborate items, and as the film opens, this sort of game is far along, and you'll see what the crucial items are that are brought in. Okay, so if we're all ready with the projector, let's proceed to the film. Thank you. In that it seems to me we can't really understand or begin to know where we're to go now unless we fully understand how those images worked. And also, even if our struggles are in a different arena now, obviously the code structuring us being completely different, to understand the modes of struggle that is in our cultural past. The second thing that I didn't mention about the film and that struck me so forcefully this time, not now about the Cynthia Darrington character, but the Billy Burke character. You could do a reading against the grain, it seems to me, in relation to the Billy Burke figure, in terms of saying that the film kind of exposes in this glaring fashion the total oppressive nature of this mother, sacrifice figure. I mean, it just screams at a contemporary audience in a way that I think was completely unavailable to the audiences of the time. Now, in terms of the ending, I just wanted to make one comment about that and then see what questions people have from the floor. You sat here for a long time very patiently. What Ozra said about the ending, the interviewers pressed her about did Cynthia really mean to die or not? Because there is that moment where she seems to hesitate to want to pull the mask back on, and she said very clearly in the interview, no, she meant to die, that was the only possible solution, it had to be. So on that note, are there any sort of questions, responses, comments people want to make, and what will we do about sound? But let's try anyway, yeah.
What was the press reaction at that time to the strong image of a woman, career, love? How did the press...
Yeah, as far as I know, I didn't read reviews recently. The film was an enormous success, and also Ozra says it was her favorite of the films that she's made. But you know, reviews, when you read reviews, they're notorious in not focusing on anything central, and what they tend to do with women's films and with melodramas, particularly the women's genre, is always to put it down, to go for the aesthetic reasons. That it's very easily attackable in terms of probability, the dialogue, the cliches, the corniness, and so forth, and there would sort of be that sort of aesthetic response. I don't remember that the gender issue was a problem. Any other responses? Yeah. Zoe Atkins did the script. The question was, who wrote the script and why did Ozra choose this project? First of all, Zoe Atkins. So it was a female, yes, and a well-known and much evident in Hollywood. Women critics are only just beginning to work on the echelons of women, the women in the echelons of power in Hollywood in terms of editing and so forth, and we don't know nearly enough about those people, and that's a lot of archival work to be done. Now, in terms of choosing the project, mainly directors don't choose projects. Mainly they're assigned projects, but I think this, pardon? Well, ever. Really? In Hollywood, it may not be quite true, but you're just simply assigned projects. And I don't know about what interaction took place. Somebody here may know how it came that it was hers. I assumed it was simply a project that was assigned her. I know that she talks in the interview about wanting certain projects that she couldn't get and being given kinds of things. There was nothing in what I read about how she got this one. The question was, do I think it would have been a better film or more successful? More successful if she hadn't killed herself. I think that the ending simply raises the whole issue of desire in the film, and each time I look at it, I kind of read it slightly differently. One thing that struck me this time, and I looked very carefully, if you go through the way the images go, okay, it begins with, it sort of works chronologically in terms of the film. As she's thinking in her mind, the image of their romantic love, it's my first love, it's your love, my first and last love, she says. And then of the time when he says, I died a million times, their illicit meeting, her hand in the frame, the consummation of their love. So it seems to me she's reviewing the transgressive nature of her acts, which was going for her desire against patriarchal law, as it were. Then comes in the patriarchal discourse strongly. Monica now speaking the patriarchal discourse. I didn't take an angel. I didn't take Harry from an angel. And then Elaine's, thanks a mother's heart, you've brought my daughter back to me. All patriarchal discourse. And then, but then the last thing, so sometimes I thought, well, she has simply succumbed to the patriarchal demands. But the last one is duty, the last meeting with Christopher Strong, where he says, she says, well, would you marry me if I was pregnant? And he says, well, I would have to, it's my duty. And it's then that she seems to pull off the mask. And so my reading of that is about her desire, but her desire to be desired. That indeed it is that Christopher, she's like, you know, he can't be for her as strongly, say, as Harry was for Monica, who took the act and made the divorce, that she then, her desire to be desired becomes an issue. However, I think her letter is very important. This courage conquers all theme throughout the movie is a very strong, I mean, her courage is enormously centered, I mean, foregrounded in much of the film. And then her note says, even love. And in a certain sense, when I talk about her last act, there is enormous courage, it seems to me, in this kind of a suicide. But this is very, very controversial. Yeah. Yeah, the question was about the ethical code structuring Hollywood at this time, and really up to the 60s, okay? It's absolutely, this questioner is absolutely right. The codes governing what was permissible were extremely strict, and scholars now, Tom Anderson is just doing a book on the 50s, on the political issues in the 50s, and he's been reading the memos back and forth from the higher ups to the lower echelons, and absolutely, only certain things could be permitted. They knew, we often say about these films, they really didn't know what was going on. It was sort of somehow in the culture generally. He's saying it's not, that's not so. It was very explicit. And indeed, the Hays Code was there. There were certain requirements. And yeah, an ending like that, presumably. But did she run out somehow and went off happily? Or, pardon? Yeah, the codes of the time would not have permitted that. Yeah. Well, the two alternatives the question is speaking about are, one, a noble motive that sort of, she wanted to sacrifice for his family, wanted his family to remain intact. The other one?
What's the other one?
Yeah, that she simply didn't want to go on without him. I think both are there. The second one, you see, is perversely noble in my you know, you could say it's noble, but it's very much simply succumbing to the patriarchal order to sacrifice yourself because these others can get on better without you. You know, I think the film, I thought it was noble. Yeah, I'm saying that I don't think I do. Yeah. Yeah, the question was that there is a third possibility that the codes of the film couldn't really honor, namely that she renounce. Well, it would have said that, well, you see, to renounce love for a woman. I mean, it's the love between, choice between love and career, love and fighting. We weren't really supposed, certainly in the 30s. Yeah, I think that's too difficult for the codes of the time. That's precisely what the Amy film actually takes up. Do we have to? Yeah. Come.
I'd like a round of applause for Anne Kaplan, who's been tremendously helpful in constructing this whole program. Lunch is now in McIntosh Hall, which is just halfway across the yard, right out the door to your left. Those of you who haven't picked up your packets with your lunch ticket, please go to the registration table. Thank you.